Hey everybody, and welcome to the DieCast. I'm Chris, and with me is Josh.
Hello.
And Rutskarn.
Not hosting to sleep.
And Seamus.
Hi there.
And I guess to kick us off, we'll do our usual what everybody be doing thing segment. Josh, what is it you be doing thing?
I have been playing a lot of Dark Souls 2. Which, everybody loves hearing me talk about the Dark Souls games on the podcast.
The Dark Souls seems to be one of those things where when somebody gets into it, it's actually sort of the physiologically impossible for words to come out of their mouth that don't have to do with that thing.
The problem is these games are so goddamn long.
Right. And there's so much complexity to them that you need to internalize to survive any given 40-second stretch of the game. And so, since you have this sort of idea that your life is fleeting, and that you are spending hours of your life learning how to survive minutes of your life, you need to somehow carry that information into other arenas. It's okay, I understand. I read every Pester log in Homestuck.
So basically, I've been on this month-and-a-half-long Dark Souls binge, and I haven't finished either one. I was almost finished with Dark Souls 1 when Dark Souls 2 came out, and I was like, I'm not going to wait till I finish Dark Souls 1 to start playing Dark Souls 2. So I put Dark Souls 1 to the side, and I haven't really been back to it, and I've been playing Dark Souls 2 since then. So, and now I'm mostly finished with Dark Souls 2, and so it's weird. I don't know, maybe I'll go back and finish Dark Souls 1 out of like some kind of compulsive need to finish the first game before I finish the second game.
Are you going to go back and do New Game Plus? Because unlike a lot of games, New Game Plus in Dark Souls is supposed to be kind of substantive, like a little bit of new story content and also way harder.
So what I know about Dark Souls 1, there's not a whole lot of new content in New Game Plus. I'll probably not do New Game Plus in it anyway, like... Despite the fact that I actually like Dark Souls 1 better than Dark Souls 2, Dark Souls 2 just has such a massively greater player population that if I ever want to do co-op, Dark Souls 2 is basically where I have to do it. So I did that stream, like, a few weeks ago when Dark Souls 2 came out, for just showing the game off for like 4 hours, and you guys got me to pick the really shitty starting class that had a dagger, which was great. That was an excellent idea, because we spent like the first 3 hours of that with me getting killed repeatedly and going, what the fuck? And my impressions have improved of the game since then. It was a combination of problems with me not understanding the changes to the mechanics.
That seems to be like what I haven't played the game myself, but I have a lot of friends that are really, really into it. And the general consensus is it's like this weird shift a little bit from Dark Souls 1. But once you get over that, it's pretty enjoyable, even though it's flawed. And I think a lot of people are still hating on it.
Feels a bit more sluggish than Dark Souls, and you just kind of have to get used to it. I'm not a huge fan of some of the changes. Like with Dark Souls 1, when you rolled, you had a set number of invincibility frames where you could not get hit by an attack. Depending on what, like, tier of roll you had, you know, fast roll, medium roll, fat roll, which is so called because it looks like a fat guy trying to roll.
So the Star Wars
is always really funny to watch. Yes, yes, exactly that. In this game, though, in Dark Souls 2, there's actually a stat, a derived statistic that affects how many invincibility frames you have in a roll, so you need to pump that stat to get decent, like, rolling invincibility that has, like, a margin for error, and the default is really low, and it's really easy to get killed, even though you think you should be invincible, from the feeling of Dark Souls 1. So I wasn't a huge fan of that. The game is really weirdly, like, dependent on co-op in a way that Dark Souls 1 was not. Like, You noticed in the stream when I was dying a lot, my health was dropping. My maximum health would drop with each death. The only way to reverse that is to burn a human effigy, or not burn a human effigy, but use a human effigy. It's the new humanity, like we saw me using in Dark Souls 1, to become human again. Or, and this is new, you need to help someone in co-op. And the thing is, you can't, like in Dark Souls 1, it was really easy to farm humanity. You could do it in a whole bunch of places. But in Dark Souls 2, like, A, enemies stop respawning after a certain number of deaths, which is, I don't know how I feel about that.
That's easily the most controversial mechanic, and, as far as I can tell.
And you have to use a consumable item to make them respawn after that.
Well, the idea for that was to prevent, like, gem or soul hoarding, right? Like, you want it to be a challenge, but if you've cleared the entire area of bad guys, like, it's something I think Seamus would really like. If you've cleared the area of bad guys, like, 10 times, and you keep dying at the boss, the game basically at a certain point stops spawning all the trash mob before the boss.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that's the idea, and it's kind of to balance out the reduced maximum health mechanic, I think, a bit.
Yeah. Okay, see, from my perspective,
if you keep grinding against this level, you will eventually have the inertia to just get rid of all the mobs.
So the thing is, I don't actually think, how the way Chris put it, like, that's a good mechanical compromise, if that's why they did it. Like, Josh is suggesting other reasons why they prevented a mob respawning after, like, 10 goes, but that's actually not something that's good for a person like me, because for me,
I think
it's still
14, which...
Okay, 14.
Yeah, it might as well be a million. I'm done at, like, 4 or 5, so...
Yeah, that's still 14 too many. It's still, I didn't want to do this in the first place. You're still making me do it a bunch of times when really, even if, like, there's no enemies, I've still got to run through a big empty area. See, I want a quick save, and everybody else wanted what they had in the first place. So if this was a compromise, it was a terrible one.
I just love, you know, I didn't want to do this in the first place. I don't want to be playing your damn game. This is stupid. I don't even know why I'm here.
To clarify, I didn't want to be rerunning the area in the first place. I've already played it once.
There were probably twice as many bonfires in Dark Souls 2 as there are in Dark Souls 1. They're just everywhere. Dark Souls 1 was, like, really tense at times because it was always a balance of, okay, I'm down to almost no Estus flask. I've got maybe, like, 2 Estus flasks yet, and I have no idea when I'll find the next bonfire. Maybe it's not for another half level. Do I go back to the bonfire and use the souls I have to level up, or do I risk all those souls and keep going and potentially die and then not be able to get back to where I was and get my stuff back? That was an interesting mechanic. And
I get that.
And in Dark Souls 2, bonfires are, like, everywhere. I mean, there's a bonfire in an area that is, like, just a little mini, tiny little, like, 5-minute dungeon run from the first bonfire in the area, and then you can unlock a shortcut that makes it so you can run from that bonfire to the second bonfire in, like, 1 minute. It's a completely meaningless shortcut because there's a bonfire right there, and you can warp to any bonfire in the game instantly.
Okay, so I get why this is, like, people like this, but again, to me, this is like hearing somebody say, so yeah, like, at the park, they added a bunch of bathrooms in, and it used to be like it was really tense when you're walking, like, am I gonna make it to a bathroom, or am I gonna pee myself? But now it's like they're everywhere.
But if I can get back to the co-op thing for a second, so humanity is super rare in this game, and the second you die, you know, you need to get humanity back to reverse your death penalty. But you can use co-op to, if you fulfill your co-op obligations, which depends on which soapstone you use, which summon thing you use, and they added a new one. It's called a small soapstone, puts a little tiny summon sign down, and if you kill like five mobs while you're in your ally's world, whoever you're helping, you get duty fulfilled and get tossed back to your world with full humanity and everything recovered. And that is apparently the primary way that you recover from deaths, is to go help someone else, which is kind of cool, I guess, but as soon as the game population kind of drops, that's going to be a problem, I imagine. And it is really, really weird that it's it makes the game a whole lot easier that if I ever run into a situation where I'm out of, like, you know, health consumables or my weapon is about to break or I'm out of spells, I can just drop a little summon sign down and run around a little bit, wait for another player to come by, summon me, and then pop into their world, kill two things for like 3 minutes, and then leave and have a full recovery right there. It makes the whole game kind of far easier than it should be. And you can do that at the boss. You can put your sign down right at the boss room, get a preview of what the boss is going to be like to fight yourself, and then help someone else beat it, get a whole bunch of souls, recover all of the stuff that you used to get to the boss, so you're at like you had just rested at a bonfire, and then you can go into the boss with all your stuff. I don't know, I like some aspects of it, but it seems like the second that you start to run into population problems in the earlier areas, it's an MMO problem, basically, then it's going to become really difficult to actually do anything in the game.
But isn't that the point of the game, is to be really, really difficult? Like, that's the whole game's aesthetic, is this hopeless frustration.
Right, but the way it's set up, it means most players won't experience the game as it's supposed to be. Only the people coming in later.
See, I never really accepted the idea that Dark Souls was necessarily about being crushingly difficult so much as it was about being...
Well,
punishing mistakes more than most games would.
Yes, and we can have this conversation about what difficulty means, especially in the context of Dark Souls, because Dark Souls and Demon Souls both have this weird thing where they're not ostensibly hard in the traditional sense. They're not like playing Through the Fire and the Flames on Rock Band, on Expert, on guitar, plain old fashioned.
Right. I want to be the guy.
Right.
It's kind of like the original Thief games. The way it makes the player feel good and cool is just by taking the opposite route of most games, which is making, you know, stuff easy and being forgiving and forgiving small mistakes and allowing
ways
out.
That's close enough, player. You're awesome. You get an achievement award. You try.
Yes. It's instead about creating like a set of mechanics that you need to overcome and not being particularly helpful in how you overcome them. Just being like, this is what you got to get through. This is what you got to defeat. You know, you figure it out from here.
It's sort of like being an archaeologist going down into like a pulpy Indiana Jones style tomb. Like, it's he who knows all of the secrets and all of the traps, and not even necessarily where they're laid out, but how to properly counter them. That, you know, a good cinematic metaphor is Indiana Jones like walking through the in Last Crusade, walking there, sitting there, whispering over to himself, like, only the penitent man shall pass, only the penitent man shall pass. What does that mean? And then he realizes what it means. And you get the same thing in Dark Souls, where you walk around a corner and everything says, you know, beware spider, beware spider, beware spider, and you're like, what does that mean? And then a giant spider comes around the corner. It's like, oh, I get it now.
What does that mean? That's like Drunky the Dumb Adventurer.
You know what I mean, though. Like there are these hints of what...
Usually the
try
notes
jumping.
Are significantly more cryptic, like, trap ahead, and you look into the room, and you're like, I don't see a trap, and then you kind of...
You, like, throw a torch.
Is this just a guy screwing with me, or is there actually a trap in there?
And then a hollowed walks out and is like, so would you like to buy a new timeshare?
The game's not traditionally difficult if you know what you're doing and you know how to spec yourself and you know what you're, and if you have a decent sense of timing of all the bad guys' moves, it's not a hard game. But it is hard in the sense that it will punish any mistake, timing or knowledge-wise, pretty brutally. Although, from what I understand, Dark Souls 2 does that less than Dark Souls 1.
Well, here's the thing with Dark Souls 2, is it seems like they were not making the game with the idea, like the first two games, that was punish mistakes brutally, but reward, you know, proper play. Dark Souls 2 seems a lot less fair than Dark Souls 1. It seems like... Okay, so, backstory here, the director of Dark Souls 1 and Demon's Souls, like the dude who came up with it, I don't remember what his first name is, but his last name is
Satan.
Miyazaki. Satan Miyazaki, okay, sure. He was not involved with Dark Souls 2, so somebody else was in charge, and you feel that a lot. Like, they're the attack animations. Okay, so here, in this game, obs can cancel their attack animation. Some of them do it a lot. So they'll run up to you with their weapon held up, like they're about to do a great big overhead thing, and then they'll just suddenly, like, drop, like, reverse animation back down into whatever their normal stance is. And that is super weird, because in like a hard rule for the Souls games up until now has been, once, regardless of what you are, human, like player or NPC, once you start an attack animation, you cannot cancel it. Other people can cancel it by hitting you, but you cannot yourself stop the attack animation once you commit to it.
Okay, but the question is, can you cancel your attacks in this game?
Apparently, if you, like, right after you start your attack animation, you roll, you can cancel it. I'm not sure if that was the case in Dark Souls. It might have been. But, like, this is, like, halfway through the swing animation. They stop and reverse.
Okay. Bullshit. And then it's bullshit. Sucks.
And then there's the absurd amount of, like, weird attack tracking where, like, in the other Souls
games. Oh, that pissed me off just seeing it in your game, where you do a roll around it, and they just pivot. They just pivot, and they hit you anyway.
They raise, like, in the other Souls game, they would, you know, if for, say, an overhead swing, they would raise the weapon up, and they might be able to track at the beginning of that, but once the weapon is at its apex and they start to swing, they stop. They can't move. Usually, we're talking about a boss with a great big hammer, so you still have to be kind of paying attention to where it is.
And that was the whole key. And that's the whole key of that game, is learning where that apex is. Okay, now he's locked in place. Now I sidestep. Like, that's the timing the game expected you to learn.
Now in this game, these dudes pivot like tops around until, like, maybe just the instant before their attack hits the ground, and then you can escape. And it's super punishing. It's not, like, it's got a very small window. You basically have to rely on invincibility frames at times, which you cannot do that as well unless you put a lot of points into this stat. To increase the invincibility frames in your roll. It feels like someone decided not, like when they were looking at encounters or enemies, like, how do we make this fight interesting? They said, how do we make this fight harder? You know, like, they got into a corporate boardroom and they were like, okay, this fight is good and all, but how do we make it harder for the player? And the boss fights reflect that a lot. There are a lot more bosses that just are, like, slightly bigger humanoids than you with basically all the same moveset. And if they don't feel like that boss fight is particularly difficult, they'll just, like, you know, make three of them. Or put a bunch of trash mobs that can poison you at the start. Or put some mages in the back to shoot you with stuff. They don't feel as well-crafted or interesting as the ones in Dark Souls 1, where you didn't have a lot of multiple mob boss fights. Most of the time, it was just one boss. And the ones where there were more than one boss, it was, like, a really big deal, like the Ornstein and Smoke fight, which you probably have seen stuff about. was pretty much the apex of Dark Souls boss fight design. And it was really interesting because they had completely different movesets. You had the one giant guy with the big heavy hammer that was, you know, easy to dodge but really punishing to get hit by, and then you had the really fast spear guy that would rush in and try to stab you, and you had to be really quick to avoid him. And in this game, it's like, oh, it's just the same guy, except there are three of them now, and they're really annoying to you. You just have to sit there and guard against their attacks until they're all exhausted through their combo animation that you could poke one once. It's not really interesting.
It reminds me, having not played it myself, I admit, I have not played it myself, but it reminds me of the changes made to Batman Arkham Origins, where it feels like somebody tinkered with the system without knowing why it really felt so good the first time.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like a lot of people who really like Dark Souls basically worshipped at the altar of Miyazaki, but did not fundamentally understand what made Dark Souls interesting.
That's a pity.
And, I mean, it's, that said, it's not a bad game. It's just not as good as Dark Souls 1 in that respect.
Okay. Well, that's
so
cool.
I mean, like, I like it. I'm having fun. It's just, I wish it were not as oddly constructed.
Good word use, good vocabulary use. Seamus, what have you been up to?
I am so sad Mumbles isn't here this week. I've been reading all the comic books. Oh my goodness. A few weeks ago, if you remember from the show, she recommended that I get Marvel Unlimited. And I finally did. And I sat there and I read comic books for basically 24 hours. Aside from the time I spent asleep, I read comic books for 24 hours. And I have to say, Marvel Unlimited strikes me as being an amazing, amazing deal. I am super excited about it. I mean, if all you want to, if you're a collector, like you collect them because you like to take care of the books and you want them to increase value, it's obviously useless to you. But if you just want to read a crap load of comic books, this is the only way to do it. $10 a month, and I figure in that 24-hour period, I probably read $400 worth of comic books. I mean, these things are like $2 and $3 a piece, and you could read one every 5 minutes, and you just boom, 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 right through giant collections.
Yeah, it's like a year behind, it's like a couple years behind the curve, right? Or like a decade behind the curve, how much?
I don't know, I think the newest ones I saw were like 2011-ish.
Okay, that's not too bad. I mean, it's not like I follow comics news when I can help it, because it's always something horrifying.
Right. But everybody's going to want to know what I read, so here's a quick rundown. Guardians of the Galaxy, I read that solely because the movie exists, or is existing, and is coming out. And I dug it. I don't normally get into cosmic... there's the three tiers of Marvel heroes. There's your street-level guys, you know, fighting muggers and lone supervillains and that kind of thing. Then there's your big super-powerful hero teams like the Avengers that really fight governments and terrorist organizations and that sort of thing. And then there's your cosmic heroes that are out in space fighting, you know, Mecha Satan. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, actually, I was sorry, I accidentally hit the button. Although I will say, I do want to read, like, just one issue where the scripts get switched, and you've got, like, Daredevil fighting the Kree.
Yes!
And then you've got, like, Galactus versus, like, Johnny Punk.
Yes! But I read Guardians of the Galaxy. Hard for me to follow because it's a continuation of a lot of existing characters that I didn't know. But once I got my fingers into it, I dug it. I really liked it. Then I read Spider-Man. Did not like almost any of the Spider-Man I read. I kind of randomly sampled Spider-Man, read Ultimate Spider-Man. Didn't like any, and Spider-Man is my hero. Spider-Man, I am to Spider-Man as Mumbles is to Batman. Just loved me some Spider-Man. He is my hero. And I didn't like any of the Spider-Man that I read, or very little of it.
Isn't Ultimate Spider-Man the one where, like, Dr. Octopus is factored into his origin story?
Well, I did see, I mean, I only read, like, the first, like, 10 issues or whatever, and yeah, Doc Ock is there working for Norman Osborn. Having a plan, it seems like a good idea. They have a plan, they know where it's all going, they know, okay, we're gonna have the Green Goblin, we're gonna have Dr. Octopus, we're gonna have the Lizard, let's set these people up before, so that we're not poofing people into existence, you know, like it was with the original run, where it's like, oh, here is somebody that is you've never heard of before, and now suddenly they're a supervillain. Now it can be a, oh no, this person turned into a supervillain, but it's, the problem with Ultimate is just, it feels very flat. There's no real rich character beats, the dialogue isn't fun or funny, some of the changes don't make a lot of sense, and so it's just, it's just like a competently assembled version of a story we've heard 100 times already.
Yeah, it's kind of like the new Spider-Man movies. It's like they had all of the stuff they needed to include, so they had a plan, and then the plan didn't really leave any room for spontaneity or good writing.
Right. Oh, it also
I haven't incidentally seen the Amazing Spider-Man movie. How was it?
The latest one I heard is terrible. Film Crit Hulk took a massive, massive smash. He smashed it in a massive way. Right? It was just to the point where he posits that the new Peter Parker is a sociopath. I mean, he's just a complete asshole. I haven't seen either of the movies. I can't bear to. It would break my heart.
Movie Bob, actually, he actually, in his review, he unironically just like completely straight-facedly said that for longer than he likes to admit after watching Amazing Spider-Man 2, like, his love of Spider-Man and of movies, like, just died. And he just, like, he didn't want to deal with the the Sony anymore, he didn't want to deal with the characters anymore, he didn't want to deal with nerd culture, he just wanted to go live on a fishing boat.
Yeah, and that's why I won't go see it, because I love Spider-Man too much. I couldn't sit through that. That would be too painful. But Ultimate Spider-Man, my problem with it is it also subscribes to the Walking Dead television show season 2 school of generating drama, which is, okay, who's going to pointlessly be a complete asshole for this scene and just be so completely unreasonable and out of character? Okay, roll the dice. Aunt May. Aunt May is going to be a jackass for this scene. Okay, and then later we can have them make up, and that's drama, because people are saying they're sorry. Okay, roll the dice. Okay, Peter is going to be a complete jackass this scene. So it doesn't feel like anybody's a character. Everybody's just sort of like, oh, it is my turn to generate drama, therefore I'm going to shout at you and say some horrible thing to you. You're not my real father.
This bland personality vehicles for ticking jackass time bombs.
Yeah, instead of, like, who's got the idiot ball this week, it's who's got the asshole ball this week. So I do not like Ultimate Spider-Man. I only got a few issues in. The other thing I read was Astonishing X-Men. Oh my goodness, this was the best thing that I read. Loved Astonishing X-Men. Was written by Joss Whedon. Way back, pre-Avengers.
Wait,
you know,
really?
Yeah, this is back pre-Avengers, when Joss Whedon was just, you know, another, this was like early 2000s, or maybe mid-2000s.
Back when he was writing like crappy Alien sequels.
Just after
Alien
Firefly. Yeah, probably, I really loved it, read 25 issues of it, and it was building up to this giant climax where they were on another planet and gonna save the whole world from, you know, the latest doom to imperil Earth. And then it dropped. The story dropped. I went to the next issue and it was a completely new artist, new writer, new storyline. I look and it's continued in a trade paperback that is not available on Marvel.
What the fuck?
Exactly. I mean, that's
did they forget
asshole.
What industry they were in?
Paperback novel for the X-Men.
No. Trade paperback is just a super fat comic book, basically.
Oh.
Okay, so it was still a comic book, but the point is, it's not part of this numbered series. Like, stop reading this comic book and get this giant, probably $15 comic book. This is probably out of print today.
Josh? Astonishing X-Men has been canceled.
Josh, that'd be like if you had a television show that ran for like a season, and then the story was wrapped up in a big movie that... Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, although this was worse, because it ended on a cliffhanger. It was really like a cliffhanger, like, here we go, we're gonna... And you know this had to be planned. It wasn't like they ran out of money and canceled the show. The show kept going with a new storyline. What happened? Who did this? And there was no way to... It wasn't even like this was a trick to wring money out of me. It wasn't like, oh, we're sorry, this isn't available on Marvel Unlimited. Click here to buy it. It was just like... This doesn't exist. Sorry, we can't help you. You just read 25 issues to hit this dead end. Go away.
Now go look up the wiki article on what happened and feel really sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I can't imagine how they got out of it. I'm sure, you know, they just went in and punched everybody until they won. I just kind of want to...
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of the X-Men.
See, that's a very valid thing to
Patrick
say, because...
Patrick Stewart driving around and punching people.
Comic writers, if you ever are, like, writers of, like, superhero comics, if you ever start taking your work too seriously, just remember that there's almost no cliffhanger that can't be resolved in the reader's mind by, they probably just went and go punched a people a few times, and that solved everything. The end.
They punched a people?
They punched a people. They punched a people. I did mention that I haven't had much sleep, didn't I?
Not on the podcast, that was before. If you had more sleep, you probably would have remembered that.
Also, I have to call Joss Whedon out on this. You know, X-Men are famous for having the Danger Room, which is their holographic workouts. It's the holographic workout room where they have simulated... It's a friggin' holodeck, okay?
It's the holodeck the way Worf used the holodeck. It's the holodeck for exclusively training and explosive purposes.
Yeah, combat simulation.
Except if you go back to the very early days of X-Men, in which case the holodeck is just, like, this hilarious room full of just pistons and random shit that Professor Xavier throws at you while yelling, "Serpentine! Serpentine!"
Yeah, it was originally just a whole bunch of, like, oh, trapdoor and spinning blades and stupid little...
It was
a game show. It was like... Yeah, it was like a Mario level.
A Japanese game show.
Okay, but Joss Whedon, who's been... Everybody's praised him. Everybody says how great he is, and I'll give him credit. Avengers was a pretty darn good movie. But Joss Whedon did an entire 3-issue series on a holodeck malfunction, and that is bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
No
they
kidding.
They throw a transporter malfunction in there, too.
No, but...
Did Professor Moriarty become sentient and demand that you transport him to the real Enterprise?
The holodeck became sapient.
Fake Enterprise.
The holodeck became sapient, and they had to fight it, and it took the form of a lady, a robo lady that they had to fight.
Wait. Joss Whedon is writing about like a badass lady that's kind of emotionally distant but knows how to kick ass. This is like a completely alien Joss Whedon.
He was trying to get out of his comfort zone, I think.
This is not the X-Men Star Trek crossover either, right?
No. This is just the Danger Room became self-aware, or has always been self-aware, I don't know, whatever. Holodeck malfunction, holodeck tries to kill everybody, and it was just, I was so embarrassed for him.
Seamus.
Really? More than Alien Resurrection?
Seamus.
What?
Danger Room!
We have ants around here now, so I've been going around for like a week solid every time I see something with food in it. Do you want ants? This is how you get ants. And of course nobody gets it, because nobody in this household, everybody is in this household that is not
everybody
me.
Everybody thinks you're being an asshole.
Yeah, everybody just thinks I'm being an asshole, which, to be fair,
oh,
is
Dad
true.
Oh, Dad went crazy again.
No, if you want to...
Skellman's purple drink.
If you want that, you need Seamus to do the Barry version of that, where Seamus walks in a room and goes, is that how you get ants, Seamus? Why, yes, other Seamus, that is how you get ants. Kids look up at him, and it's just very awkward.
And, you know, to be fair, out of context, this kind of reference does make you look like a jerk, but it could be worse. Yeah. You could be going around getting drunk and sleeping with stewardesses.
They're called flight attendants.
Anyway, are we done talking about comics? Seamus, any more comics?
Red Deadpool. Nothing to say about Deadpool. Haha, he's funny. Let's move on.
Rutskarn, what have you been up to?
A couple things. Well, firstly, Unrest is like a month and a half away from being from launch.
Hold the phone. Hold the phone. 2 weeks ago, you said it was a month from launch. 2 weeks later, you said it's a month and a half from launch. Have you attended the Gabe Newell School of game design here?
So this actually has nothing to do with our progress in the game. Like, we're probably still going to be done at the same time otherwise. But Arvin talked to some PR people, and it turns out that we're going to launch on June 13th, and Arvin was like, hey, nobody else is launching on June 13th. Why not? It's like, that's a great day to launch. There's no other titles coming out. And it turns out that June 10th through 12th is E3.
Oh. Oops.
So we'd already agreed that we weren't going to launch like right after that, because then we'd be competing with Divinity, which is the other Kickstarter funded RPG that's getting released at that time.
Is that really happening now?
Obviously our game's getting better than their game is, but you know, anyway,
what's obviously they're scrubs.
So the new date is the 26th. But it should be available for pre-order on Steam, like, around May 26th.
Unrest?
Yep.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. I didn't know you guys had already been greenlit.
We got a publisher.
Paradox?
That's excellent.
It is not Paradox, no.
Damn.
No, but that's fantastic.
I don't want to talk... Yeah, it's pretty good. I don't want to, like, talk about our publisher deal too much, because I actually have no idea what I am, and I'm not allowed to say, so I'm erring on the side of nothing.
Well, no, I just think it's great that you guys are actually getting on Steam and skipping Greenlight, because that is a several-month process of pain and suffering
That is a long pony ride of bullshit right there. And honestly, it's like, getting on Steam is kind of like, you know, if you're a content creator having your show on YouTube, it does not by any means guarantee success these days, but it allows it.
Yes, yeah, that's a good comparison.
It allows for the possibility of success.
Yes. If you're not on YouTube, what the fuck are you doing? It's not quite true.
Unless
that
you're
obviously,
red versus blue.
Yeah, obviously you could succeed like with as a game developer without using Steam, but it's way harder. So yeah, that's finishing up, and I'm spending a lot of time working on that. That is honestly most of what
time.
I do these days. Yes. But when I do get time to do stuff, it's actually not as much video games so much, although I've been playing some Mountain Blade. Mostly I've been playtesting my RPGs with people. Like, I've been doing Mary Sue, and Mary Sue is like 5 playtests from being ready for, like, finalization and publication. And then there's one that I just came up with for the hell of it, because it's like, we live about an hour away from, like, our old college friends, so... You know, it's like we would have a day where we would, like, get together and have some drinks, or we would have a day where we'd get together and play some board games, or we would have a day where we'd get together and play some RPGs back when we were at college. Now, if it's an hour drive, we are going over there and we're doing all of those things as much as possible, and then crashing and then driving back. It's like, you know, it's if we're going over there, you know, we just need to cover all of our bases. And for
where
with that
are you
in
living
mind,
now?
Huh?
Where, like, what part of L.A.?
It's in the sort of, I don't really want to be too specific because I'm living with people who probably wouldn't want, like, too much detailed information. About, like, half an hour from L.A.
Tell me your address, Rutskarn, so I can post it on Craigslist.
this came up, actually, is the thing.
No, I ask for the record for the diecast people, because when Rutskarn was at college, he was like a 5-minute drive from my grandparents' house, so that was kind of fun.
Yes. Anyway, so back on topic, I guess. So the other game I developed,
such before, as it is,
the other game I developed to cover all those bases was a system called Drunkens and Flagons. The basis for that is, so what's the stereotype place where adventurers get their quests? It's like a tavern, because apparently somebody decided at some point that all adventurers are alcoholics. Anyway, so the question is, like, are the adventurers just sitting there, like, sipping tap water and, like, eating bar snacks the whole time? Because if not, what if it just gets to midnight and nobody's come in yet and they're the last party in there because they kind of suck? And they're about to go home and somebody hands them the quest, they're gonna be hammered by then. So, the premise of the RPG is that, like, you're a shitty adventuring party at last call, and somebody just walked in with, like, the deal of a lifetime that, like, has a deadline of tonight, and you have to somehow accomplish this extremely difficult quest while just half in the bag. And I adapted, to some degree, the old Dresden Files RPG system. The Dresden Files system had a mechanic I really liked, which is whenever you cast a spell, like, you set a number that, like, that's the difficulty number of the spell. I need to roll that number. And if you roll less than that number, then you have a choice. You can either take it as damage to yourself, and the spell works, or you can take it as fallout to the environment, like something bad happens because your spell goes awry, but you're okay. But the spell doesn't work. And with my system, I've just made it so that that applies to everything. Like if you're trying to climb a wall or break a window or, you know, you're trying to smooth talk somebody, if you fail the check, you've got a choice of take damage and succeed, or the situation gets worse somehow. And it was a riot. What's up?
It sounds like sort of a tabletop version of maybe a surgeon simulator or a goat simulator, where the idea is that the humor inherently stems about the chaos you're causing accidentally by the sloppiness of the mechanics, but it's in a tabletop format, and I kind of really love the ingenuity of that. That's really awesome.
Yes, that's exactly sort of the feeling I was going for. And the thing is, I didn't really think of this, but the thing is, if people are willing to take the damage to themselves, and, like, you know, we hand it over, like, if you're, like, trying to pick a lock and you fail your check and you decide to take damage, it's that, like, you know, you're, like, focusing really hard on the lock and, like, you break the pick and stab yourself in the hand, but the lock actually gets picked, or, like, or you just get a headache, because you can take mental and physical damage. But the thing I didn't anticipate was, as long as people are willing to take the hit, they can do pretty much anything they want. So there was one guy who was playing a priest, and he decided that, like, so Fate has a system where you have points called Fate Points that you get for getting in trouble, or, you know, for doing things that get you in trouble that are relevant to your character. And I just made it so that the only way you can get these very precious points is you have your drunken trouble, which is something you tend to do when you're drunk that fucks things up. And I had a priest, like, somebody randomly generated.
I love this so much.
Somebody randomly generated a priest, and he decided that his thing was that, like, he was kind of like a racist dude and, like, sort of a proselytizer, like, fantasy racist. Like, he's a half elf, so he didn't like anyone. He's like, oh, those elves, oh, those humans. And he was going around, so he was going around just, like, whenever he got into a combat, I let people make their own skills, like, usually Fate has skills like guns or sneak, but I just said, like, you pick something that's your skill, like, convincing people to do favors for you, or, like, smacking the crap out of people with a stick, like, you know, you come up with a specific thing that your character is good at, and he had, like, racism as one of his skills, like, xenophobia was his skill. So, like, whenever he got into a combat with, like, non-elves, he's just like, ugh. And finally, his goddess actually showed up and was like, hey, you know, listen, I get it that you're drunk, and I get that, like, you know, you're not really in control of yourself, but you really need to cut this shit out. And what he did was, he used his other skill, which is, preaching, to convince his goddess to be more racist. He actually, like, delivered, he actually, like, mortal splained to the deity. Like, actually, you don't understand. And, like, he had to take, like, skills are, like, +3 on, like, a roll of anywhere from 0 to, like, sometimes maybe as high as +4. And I'm like, this is a difficulty 12 check. And so he got way short of it, and he had to take all kinds of, like, mental consequences. But he's like, you know, it's, he eventually, the goddess is like, you know, okay, let's give it a trial period. Just, like, for another 24 hours, anything goes. Deal? Shake hands? All right. Oh, ew, I just touched a half-elf. So, like, yeah, it kind of got a little crazy, but I think that was in everybody's best interest. I have to say, like, Chris, when you say that, there's actually, it's not really explored too much in RPG circles, but, like, a really entertaining clusterfucky system is just as entertaining as a really clusterfucky kind of buggy game.
Well, especially because that's how people, a lot of people anyway, play in D&D anyway. Like, a lot of, especially high schoolers, play D&D in that sort of, like, I hit the guy in the face, or I kick the guy in the nuts, it's funny. And that's how they play D&D, because they play it for those goofy scenarios. They don't, like, roleplay. They just sort of, like, try to do the most absurd thing possible, no matter what.
Yeah, like, stimulus response.
Exactly. And this game seems designed to, like, mechanically facilitate that in a way that doesn't mean you're subverting the system, but rather the system is designed to promote that, which is kind of awesome. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going for. And, like, the other game I'm working with, Mary Sue, like, I'll just share a little bit of how it works mechanically. The idea is that the game doesn't have a set GM, because the game is about, like, fanfiction authors who are collaborate, like, have this uneasy kind of tense collaboration where they're working at cross purposes and trying to glorify their own character and their own, like, favored narrative cliches. And so since there's no GM, like, who's writing the story and who controls the NPCs actually changes hands. Because, you know, like, a guy will be narrating, he'll be like, and then, like, the lady's like, oh, you're so awesome, and she feels up my muscles, and everybody thinks my character's the coolest. Somebody's like, nuh-uh, that wouldn't happen, my character's the coolest. And you actually roll to see who's right, and who is right becomes the GM. Like, that's like, the basic mechanic of the game is, you know, deciding who gets to control what's happening in reality.
You're doing some really interesting stuff with RPGs. I want to play RPGs with you. You seem to be, like, deconstructing them in a way that I have not seen many people do. Now, granted, I don't play a lot of RPGs, but still, I'm interested in your experiments and would like to subscribe to your newsletter, is, I guess, how I would put that.
Yeah, and which I guess actually brings me to the other point I had, which is I didn't want to talk about this, but I've been sort of working on resurrecting my website. Like, it's not going to be, like, a big, massive renovation, but, like, I'm just going to sort of talk a little bit about this. There's more to it, but I'm going to give you the short version. One of the main reasons I stopped working on my website and I stopped producing content so regularly was because I was, and to some degree still am, but was, suffering from sort of a generalized anxiety where, you know, I've seen much more extreme examples of this, like completely cripple content creators who had very much, much bigger followings than mine. But sort of this feedback of like, oh, you know, I want to work on this, but I can't, I've got so much other stuff I need to worry about, so I'll never end up sitting down and working on it now. But then, like, the longer I go without publishing content, the more tense and avoidant I feel about posting things to my website. Oh no, you know, they're never going to, like, look at my site again. Everybody's leaving me. What have I done? I've ruined everything. I might as well quit now. Like, that's the truncated version of, like, a sort of feedback loop that cripples your productivity. And, like, you know, you see how I went from posting, like, 5 things a week to posting 4 things a week to posting, like, 2 things a week, and, like, one of them would be, like, they'd be different stuff as I would get off of my schedule and start posting regularly. It wasn't because I was getting more busy, really. Like, you know, I was getting more busy. I was starting to graduate college. You know,
but even
I
with your, even when you're busy, when you've got words in your head, you will find time to put them down.
Well, that's the thing, is that I wasn't. Like, I was before. The big thing was that I had more responsibilities, and it was just more shit that I was worrying about, and that worrying is what prevented me from working on stuff. It's like, you know, like when you put, like, a kid in a playpen with, like, 20 toys, he doesn't play with any of them because he's like, you know, which one do I play with first? Like, it's like a less fun version of that, where it's like, I've got, you know, 20 things I'm worrying about, you know, most of which I can't even do anything about right now, so I don't want to sit here wasting time writing a blog post, even though, you know. And, like, similarly, I don't want to play video games. Like, I disappeared from Steam for a long time. Like, I don't want to play, you know,
I don't want to play Mountain Blade because that's wasting time and I've got all this stuff I should be doing, but I can't work on it right now, so I guess I'll just, like, commit to an activity like browsing the internet, which doesn't have, like, it doesn't require me to do it for an hour. I can do it for, like, a minute, but in reality I'm going to do it for 5 hours and nothing's going to get done and I'm going to be super unhappy and depressed. And, okay, I sort of said I wasn't going to get too much into this, and to be honest, I don't really want to get all that much into it, but the short version
is interesting topic to me. It works pretty differently for me, but I don't want to bore everybody with my story, especially since it's not particularly, like, I don't have this anxiety, so it'll just be this really boring story. It won't be as interesting as yours. but it is interesting how the different ways people react to self-imposed work. You know, I mean, it's one thing if you've got to go to the job every day and do the job. And you do the job whether you want to do the job or not, because if you don't do the job, you'll get fired. But how do you handle these situations where you have a job that you can do or not, and the only person making you do it is you? And I'm fascinated at, the fact that we have trouble doing it at all, and we all do, and B, that we have so many different ways of having trouble with it. That's just so interesting to me. And, you know, the number of dead blogs out there far, far, far outpaces the number of ongoing blogs. This is not a rare or exotic problem. This is something that I think most people go through. And so I find just to some very, extent or another, very interesting. Yeah, to some extent or another, yes.
In some cases, it's just as simple as, like, losing interest. But I never felt like I was really losing interest in running a blog. I lost interest in series. Like, honestly, like, my Elder Scrolls Let's Plays, Morrowind was really fun to do, Oblivion was less fun, and then Skyrim was just kind of a chore. Because I didn't like playing Skyrim all that much. And I was more avoidant about playing the game, so it never got... Anyway. The point is, people have gone through this much worse, but I think... Like, Terrell Hunt is a web cartoonist, and he recently posted a post where he was explaining sort of thought processes, and I recognized a milder version of a lot of them myself. And one of them that he said was, he got into this pattern of thinking of his readers like his boss. And I never made money off of Chocolate Hammer, but, like, that's kind of how I felt. Like, I felt like my readers were, like, you know, old man Winters waiting up in his office, and when I show up late for work, is there tapping his watch, like, you need to do better there, Rutskan. You're not going to be with this firm much longer if you continue to pull these monkey shines, eh? So, when I was late with the blog post...
If I had a boss that talked like that, I would make sure to get in as much trouble as possible so that he could chew me out as often as possible.
And then you do something right, and he's like, alright, great work, Seamus.
He only chews you out in Atlantic accent.
Yeah, but it's like, when I was late with stuff, it got worse, because I felt like, or when I felt like I was late with stuff, I felt this pressure that made me not want to think about it or work on it. And I won't say that I've beaten this, because I haven't. I really haven't. But I've gotten better. Like, I've gotten much better at this. I'm in a much happier place now. Like, I'm sort of, I've figured out, like, that if I spend some time just working on this stuff, I'm generally happier, and I work more efficiently.
Yes. Yes.
And, yeah, so that's basically, like, I've decided to resurrect the site. I've already been working on posts for it. There's an Elder Scrolls series I'm going to launch, like, finally. Going to launch that Elder Scrolls series. And I have some other stuff, which I don't want to talk about it now, but I think, like, writing about experiments with RPG design is one thing I really want to do, because I think, you know, like Chris said, like, I actually do play a lot of independent role-playing games. I do play a lot of weird out there stuff, and a lot of it's, you know, like, I've run up to stuff that I thought was, like, really experimental, and, like, I think even pushes the boundaries more than a lot of the stuff I do, but it was never published stuff. It was always stuff that, like, an indie dude came up with and just put for free on a blog somewhere. And I'm not saying that's what I'd do. I think I'd rather sell it, actually, but... Like, the industry itself is stagnating somewhat. Like, you guys mind if I talk a little bit about, like, some sort of weird games that I've played that, you know, just really sort of make you think about the mechanics and how, like, this kind of game works?
I'm down.
All right, so there's one that people recognize if they caught the Anti-Paladin, which is Everyone is John. Because the idea of Everyone is John is, like, the GM is running, you know, it has a GM. The GM's running the game. But all of the player characters are playing the same character, John, who is sort of a mentally ill man who has several distinct dissociated identities with different skills and, like, different things that they're pretty good at, which is to say that they're competent at, and everything else each identity is terrible at. Like, even things like, you know, crossing the street, saying hello to someone, you know, like, buying a newspaper, is, like, it's really hard for this guy to do. But, like, each identity is really good at a few random things. Like, the GM will actually give you three random skills, like driving a car, or, like, karate, or, like, singing and dancing. And before the game begins, before you even find out what your skills are, you write down three goals that your identity has, ranging from easy to hard. Easy ones being, like, you know, shake hands with people. And hard being, the hardest goal I've ever successfully accomplished was defeat the CEO of a major corporation in a televised fist fight.
That's oddly specific.
Exactly. They have to be, like, really hard to do. And the game works that only one person is in control of John at any given time, but if you fail something, and it's really easy to fail when you're doing anything you're not great at, then, like, basically it's like a basketball that, like, gets the toss-up, and everybody has to, like, sort of wrestle for the ball. Like, everybody has to wrestle for control of John, and, like, switch horses in midstream and try to accomplish their goals now. Like, the only reason I managed to accomplish that goal was because somebody else was trying to hijack an airplane, and I managed to, like, they tried to climb up into the airplane, and they failed and, like, hit the ground and hit a baggage cart. And I had acrobatics, so I jumped onto a baggage cart and surfed it back into the terminal. And I had singing, so I used that to sing out, and, like, by the way, the character's naked at this point. Just thought that was a pertinent detail. Used it to, like, sing an operatic aria calling somebody out to fight me, or, like, a CEO out to fight me, or else, like, I'm going to institute a reign of terror, and, like, senseless lives will be lost. Like, now's your chance to forgive PR for your company. And the news crews had already arrived, so it's televised now. And so the guy, like, says, I guess I'll, and then I just jump on him and I punch him, and it's like, everybody's like, wait, that was your goal? How the fuck did you pull that off? That's sort of the goal of the system, is, like, to reach seemingly impossible ends from very limited resources, where failure is frequent, and in fact, the driving force of the game.
That's pretty awesome.
Now I've heard everything.
I think the most extreme goal that I didn't quite accomplish was have a stereotypical, like, culturally appropriated luau. Like, you know, usually the GM's kind of lenient. Like, for example, I wasn't able to get a pig, so I actually just had to, like, kill a dude and try to put him on a spit, like, above an oil fire in an alleyway. And I was just trying to turn Venetian blinds
like
into grass. I was
sounds
just trying
like
to turn
a luau
Venetian
to me.
I was just about to try to turn Venetian blinds into a skirt and use the, like, curtain rods as the skewer when I got hit with, like, a random skill check and I failed it. And that was the end of the game, actually, because at that point we were all out of points.
So the game doesn't end when you finally kill this poor guy with your ineptitude. It just ends when everybody's out of point. What did he run out? What happened to John? Did he run out of personality and and go into a coma? What does this end look like?
Basically, yes. Because I should say that the other thing is John loses consciousness. And basically, the switchovers happen whenever you fail skill check or whenever John loses consciousness. And John loses consciousness whenever he gets bored, which is whenever nothing happens for 10 minutes. So once there's a situation where it was another, like, airport situation. I think it was actually after I defeated the CEO. The guy managed to get back control, get on the plane, and he hijacked it. He's like, take me to France. And so the plane went to France, but it was a long flight. And by the time it happened, somebody else had control. And it turns out that person actually wanted to be a member of the Russian ballet. So that person was like, as soon as he wakes up, like, in France, they're like, okay, now take me to Russia. So then they fly to Russia. But it was a long flight, so he fell asleep. And then the other guy got control again, and he's like, okay, take me back to France.
This is the infinite fuel jetliner.
And you just imagine the pilot, like, there's just this naked guy sitting next to him, like, just, like, waking up as soon as he lands, like, okay, take me to Russia. The pilot's just like, where's an air marshal when you need one?
Oh, boy, that was, I kind of like that story.
You know, I will say I have a really good gaming group. And, like, you know, fun stuff happened with this group, but I appreciate systems that encourage it happening sometimes. You know, you can have a big, fat, solemn system, and honestly, it seems like one of the reasons the industry is in a rut is because people who make their own RPG systems, they're less interested in creating a system that is intrinsically entertaining, and creating mechanics that have good, I'm going to borrow your word, like, it's almost like kinesthetic feel. Like, that's not quite the right word, but that's close. Like, that have good, like, that good play feel that encourage the sort of thing you want them to encourage. Like, they don't have that goal. Their goal is to represent as straightforwardly as possible a setting that they have in mind. Like, they don't start from, I want to make an RPG that's fun. They start from, like, I want to make an RPG around my, like, homemade reptilian conspiracy game. And then they get really bogged down in, like, okay, well, how can I really just represent the minutiae of bribing a bureaucrat to pass a resolution and have it not get caught by watchdog agencies in a way that's fair? And it ultimately doesn't end up helping anybody.
Yeah, I could totally see that, where you just over-simulate, especially on paper. Over-simulation sucks on a PC, look at SimCity and just roll your eyes, but over-simulation on paper is just tedious. On paper, if you have to, like, okay, roll to check to see if the guy at the bank checks, opens the envelope. Okay, now roll to see if anyone ever investigates what's in the envelope while it's stored. Okay, now roll to see if anybody...
Insert like, grappling rules joke here.
Yeah, like, I know a lot of fans of Shadowrun who claim that there's never been a good Shadowrun system, and I think that's...
I don't know enough about Shadowrun to say whether or not that's true.
I'm not going to go too much into it, but, like, you know, it's just the idea that you've got these settings that people love, but really the game has never felt good.
I'd believe that, because I do know that it's this weird, really weird, delicate balancing act between physical combat magic and hacking, and it's this really... apparently it's really hard to balance all that stuff.
The Shadowrun systems I have encountered and that I've evaluated have all been very simulationist, and it's to the point where, like, playing the game would be kind of like, honestly, a good comparison is comparing XCOM UFO Defense, like the original, to XCOM Enemy Unknown. You know, where UFO Defense was very much like, okay, we want you to feel as much as possible like you are actually a guy controlling a team of squaddies who's going out and fighting these aliens, and, like, you've got to deal with, you know, the sort of the paperwork of running your base. And it was really cool. And to be honest, you know, if you could do that in an RPG system, like a tabletop system, that would also be pretty cool. But part of the reason that simulationist approach can work, like, you can have your Rainbow Sixes and your, like, SWAT 4s and your XCOM UFO defenses, is because the computer does all the hard work. Yeah. And when people try to do that in pen and paper, it never works out. So, pen and paper RPG designers, my advice to you is, for the most part, I mean, there'll always be niches of people who enjoy simulationist RPGs, and that's okay. But it doesn't hurt to think of it. Don't try to make XCOM UFO Defense. Try to make XCOM Enemy Unknown. Make a game that just feels really good and delivers the emotional payload and, like, the sort of the excitement and the feeling you want. Because XCOM Enemy Unknown feels a lot like XCOM UFO Defense does, ultimately. It just, it's less granular. It's more abstract.
Yep. Okay, so do we want to...
So, Campster...
Yeah.
What have you been video
Josh,
gaming?
Josh, no. Bad Josh. I'm the host.
No.
I was actually going to ask, do we want to... The only thing I've been playing this week, aside from everything I was already playing last week, unless anyone wants to talk about anything I've been playing last week, Seamus, is I've been playing a lot of Civilization games, like all the Civilization games save for Civ Rev, because I'm doing a video on them. So
you haven't been playing much, finally, except you've been playing all of the most addictive games in history that are infamous for being massive time sinks.
I haven't really done drugs this week except for all the heroin.
Well,
we should play multiplayer Civ. I promise.
We're not gonna play multiplayer Civ ever. I don't like turn-based multiplayer.
No, we should totally do it. We should do it as a stream.
My point was just, do we want to have me talk about stuff that might show up on my show, or do we want to move on to the mailbag?
Oh, you can talk a little bit, like, when it comes to stuff that I'm going to post on my site, or like in the Kickstarter updates for Unrest, I think of the diecast as like the editor's note section, like the behind-the-scenes section. So if there's anything like that for Civilization that, like, you don't think you'll have time for in the video, or, like, you know, you haven't really thought out through 100% yet, then that's the kind of thing I usually share.
Oh, added to that, if I have an argument I'm building or a point I'm making, I like to make it here verbally, and then people will pick at it, and then I'll okay, this is all the things people are going to say about it. Now when I go to write a column, I'll know what to say to harden against those points.
I'm definitely not bringing up the article's main point, so I guess I'll bring up Rutskarn's sort of editor's notes. I've kind of got two points I've got sort of in the back of my head. First of all, I still haven't picked up Civ 3 or Civ 1 yet, because I basically have to pirate it, because it's almost impossible, short of going to a flea market picking up Civ 1. Like, it's almost impossible to find Civ 1 these days. But I have a copy of Civ 2, and I've played Civ 2, Civ 3, and Civ 4, and Civ 5, and Alpha Centauri, all in the past week. And I have to say, it's this weird thing where...
You haven't slept?
Well, no, I've actually been playing, like, you know, 2 or 3 hours of each so far. I mostly it's been footage capture. I've played them all historically. It's sort of refreshing my mind about their mechanics.
You play until Gandhi does something funny, and then you hit save.
I actually don't have any Gandhi in any of the games I've been playing, which is kind of weird.
You need to select Gandhi as all of your opponents.
I don't think
everybody's
that's possible.
Everybody's India.
More like Gandhi.
But... the thing that I find is that the biggest change, like, aesthetically over the course of Civilization's existence for me, going from Civ 2 through to Civ 5, has been that the game sort of shifts from an almost RPG-esque approach to running a civilization to a very board game approach to running a civilization, and it's kind of interesting. Like, in Civ 2, you got to pick... You got to pick your civilization, and that shows your bonuses. But choosing your civilization basically just shows your bonuses and your color. Everything else, your title, the kinds of buildings you get, your name, your gender, all of that, you got to sort of custom pick. And you don't get that anymore in Civilization. These days, it's like, you are the Mongols, and you are Genghis Khan of the Mongols, and you will go, and you can rename him, but aside from that, your icon is Genghis Khan, you are Genghis Khan, or whoever you pick. It's very locked into sort of picking a default. It's less role-playing and more, I am this...
Historical fan fiction.
Aww.
Yeah. Self-insertion fan fiction.
I like the role-playing.
Civ 2 was kind of weird about that, though, because they insisted on having a female ruler for every nation, so it got into weird stuff where, like, the Japanese sun goddess is the female ruler of Japan.
They really couldn't come up with anybody else, like, anyone historically that would have been more appropriate?
Well, I can't imagine anyone for Japan. I think the female ruler for America was Eleanor Roosevelt. Joan of Arc was the one for France.
Well, she was married to a head of state. That's nearly like being in charge of something.
I could definitely see why they did it, but, like, on the other hand, I could see why they're running up against the problem there.
Yeah. So that was the only game in the series that did that.
It's less a bad idea and more depressing, really.
But... I don't know. You had other things too. Like in older Civ games, you had like the throne room or the palace that you got to customize and upgrade as you went through time,
yeah,
as long as people loved
cool.
you. And they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, that was cool, but that bugged the shit out of me because like it was really asymmetrical. So like you would want to put in a pillar, and then like you'd put in one pillar on one side, and then you'd have to wait until for like 100 in-game years to put the pillar on the other side, and it's bullshit.
It wasn't. No, that was the palace. The the actual throne room worked symmetrically. The problem with the throne room was there was like 18 things to upgrade, so like you could focus on your throne for the first 3,000 years of your rule and go from like a crappy hovel to like an actual throne, but you're still surrounded by like animal carvings and caves. Like it's 800 yes. BC and suddenly you're still like in caveman years, but you've got this awesome rockin' throne that makes no sense.
There should be more theme capital buildings.
Okay, but you do realize the game is like, that's the other thing I forgot, is how old Civ 2 and Alpha Centauri are. Like, I had to jump through a million hoops to get Alpha Centauri to run, and Civ 2 is, like, so old they have the FMV advisors, where it's, like...
Civ 2 is, like, 95 or 96, I think.
It's really old, and it's maybe shockingly old.
I don't know. Civ 3 was 2001, I think.
I mean, the other thing that I miss, the last RPG-y element that I really do miss, the one that is the most gameplay impactful, like, I like in Civ 2 how you can choose the building types, and I like in Civ 2 how you can choose your name and your gender and sort of, like, your title, and, like, I am Archduke Campster, and I'm a dude, and my buildings are Asian-themed, and, like, that's kind of cool that you can choose your Civ like that.
Yeah.
But what I really miss more than anything is meaningful government management, where historically in Civilization II, you could choose like, oh, we're a despotism where I just decide what goes, or we're a democracy, which means that I get all these advantages, but also a bunch of disadvantages, like I can't unilaterally declare war for no reason. And there were all these pros and cons of choosing what government type you wanted to have, and things like slavery and the other sort of Civ social design bonuses actually mattered. They were as much role-playing as they were gameplay bonuses, whereas when you look at Civ 5, sculpting your civilization's sort of government structure is that stupid social tree where you're unlocking things permanently, where we have celebrated, you know, liberty since the dawn of man. We have chosen liberty or piety or whatever as one of our civilization's values, and it's really uncomfortable because in the older Civ games it made sense, where we're a democracy until we go to war, and then suddenly things fall into despotism, and first of all, that generates this really interesting narrative of how despotism is more useful when going to war, but it also let you sort of roleplay this thing where, no, I believe in democracy, we preserve democracy at war, or, yeah, screw it, we're going to despotism because I need to win this thing. You know, it let you sort of both roleplay and sculpt a narrative, whereas the modern games are just sort of like, oh yeah, I use all my social points and put them all into the science one, because the science one gives me science plus 5, and it's not roleplay-y, it's more board game-y min-max, and I'm not a super big fan of that.
You know, this is planted in my head by the LARP, and I don't want to distract too much from your point, but, like, I do kind of want to play a Crusader King-style game where you play one ruler who is somehow immortal, who just has to oversee, like, thousands of years of his civilization's reign, and, like, has to watch them start clamoring for different types of government and decide, well, am I gonna, you know, become... Am I going to allow a democracy to overtake?
President for life!
Am I going to allow this to switch to a democracy and just try to run for office? Or am I going to, you know, put my foot down and say, no, I'm dictator for life?
The other thing that I found really weird, and this is my other point, and we can move on to the questions, but Alpha Centauri, I probably haven't played since it came out, since probably 2005. Not when it came out, but like the last time I played it was like, you know, almost 10 years ago. And, I would have been like 20 when I played it, and I was dumb, and I was a kid, and now pushing 30, playing it again, holy crap is that game cynical. Like, that game is really, like, bitter about our future in a way I did not pick up on when I was a kid. Like, nerve-stapling people, and all of these different factions are... Seamus complained about some of the factions in an earlier podcast, I think, or maybe when we were just talking, but playing it again... Every one of these factions is a terrible person. Every one of them is a terrible person. And I didn't pick up on that as a kid, but I pick up on that now. I'm like, oh my god, all of these people are horrible people. Like,
Turns out Alpha Centauri is the new Australia.
Well, I mean, Morgan...
Penal colony, where they send people they don't like.
Every single one of them is a terrible... All of the seven leaders are... basically terrible people, and every faction is so dedicated to its own ideology that they actively hurt or kill other factions in a way that is really bad, and none of them are respectable.
I think some of them are more I think some of them are more evil than others. Like the
well, some of them-
the earth, the environmentalist chick always seemed to be one of the more reasonable ones, and the science guy wasn't.
Really? Deidre's guy is one of the more extreme ones, I thought. I mean, so is really the only one that I thought was the okay, I'll put it this way. I think the biases of Brian Reynolds or Sid Meier or whoever was responsible for writing this game clearly comes through in the way these characters are shown. And I do think basically that Deidre Sky and Miriam, Sister Miriam, and a few others get the short end of the stick. Nabutake Morgan, those three get about like the worst painting of being just the most cartoonishly evil. Also, maybe Shenzi Yang. Those four get the most like cartoonishly evil. But even like Peacekeeper Lol is this giant hypocrite, and the university academician Prokhor Zaharov is basically this giant guy who lives in like theory and ideas and doesn't really care about human beings. And they're all terrible people. Every one of them, every ideology there is terrible. You know, Santiago is nothing but a militarist who wants to go to war against every other faction. All of them are terrible people. Every one of them is in some way like an incomplete whole, and as a result, they're bad people.
I hate to say it, but this kind of makes me want to play this game.
Have you never played it?
It's good. It is good.
It's really dated, having played it recently, insofar as technology-wise, it's really dated, was and
it,
also...
It was the Civ 2 engine, wasn't it?
Okay,
it
so...
It was a
cancer.
It was...
I recently played through the entire Elder Scrolls game from Arena.
You would actually like it, because the other thing that's interesting about Alpha Centauri is that, unlike pretty much every other Civ game, it's got sort of a set narrative. There are interludes that deliver a text-based narrative and a storyline, and there's sort of a set plot structure, despite the fact that it's basically a Civilization game. It's really interesting. You would probably really like it. It's this sort of depressing cyberpunk dystopia on another world where basically we're making all the same mistakes as before, except instead of all of us making the same mistakes, each faction is making its own mistakes based on its ideology. You know, blind love of capitalism, blind love of science, pure blind science. Pravin Lal, the peacekeeper from the UN, is like this giant hypocrite who simultaneously insists that, oh, we're part of the UN mission and everything's great and we're all a part of the same team. By the way, if you don't give me that technology, I'm going to bomb your city. You know, all of these people are terrible people, every single faction.
Yeah, that actually, like, so what's your goal?
Kill everybody.
That's kind of, the goal, okay. The goal is civilization style. There's a number of ways to win, and I this is kind of a spoiler, given that there's a set narrative, but I guess I'll just... Okay, I won't spoil it. But there is... You know how the space race is sort of the ultimate science goal in Civilization? There is an ultimate science goal in Alpha Centauri, and that kind of is where the narrative points you to. And it's not the only way to win, but it is sort of the canonical way to win.
That's interesting.
So, of the five... Yeah, five games that you played. Which one was your favorite? Which one would you say is the best Civ game?
That's a loaded question.
And is it Alpha Centauri?
The answer is no.
And if not, why are you so wrong?
Alpha Centauri's biggest problem.
I don't actually know.
Alpha Centauri's biggest problem in having played it recently is I still don't really understand the upgrade system for how to upgrade your units. I will get tech, and tech will say, you can upgrade your units. And I'm like, okay, yes, 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 yes. And I assume I'm upgrading my units? I don't really know. It's a rather confusing system. The whole tech tree is rather confusing, because you're not upgrading, like, it's not like future tech leads to replacing Minutemen with Riflemen. It's more like, you've researched some abstract science like string theory, and that gives you access to an engine that lets you move your cars further. So upgrade all of the engines to all of your cars, because you can customize your units, which changes their cost and also their abilities, so you can have more expensive but better units, or cheaper but crappier units. But it's a very very, very overcomplicated system, and that still confuses me. But
it was my favorite part of the game. That was the part I loved. But I always like to try and make a small number of just ungodly, mega expensive super units, like a unit that could conquer a city by itself. Go halfway across the map. And I just imagine these things to be these giant doomsday weapons.
You're the kind of dude that would build one Gundam instead of 1,000 tanks.
Yes, that's exactly the approach. Completely impractical, obviously, but I enjoyed doing it.
The other thing I like about Alpha Centauri is that it doesn't have the burden of the creeping undertones of barbarians, because the planet itself is sort of warring against you, and I really love that because, A, it solves the creepy problem of barbarians, which is this weird thing that is kind of uncomfortable if you think about it for too long, and B, it provides combat pretty much constantly throughout the game. So Alpha Centauri, despite taking place in the future, is an even more combat unit-centric game, because mind worms are constantly attacking your civilization, and you need to constantly be vigilant against them. Even if you're at peace and playing a peaceful civ, you need to play with a military mind, because you're always under attack from the planet itself, which is, I think that's also kind of cool. But
yeah, well, what I hated in, I think it was Civ 4, Civ 3 or 4, I can't remember now, but I had a game where, like, quote-unquote barbarians were fielding tanks from their, you know, lone, like, I was the only person in the world with this super technology, and they were, no, it was battleships, a barbarian battleship, like, they were, like, this is something that takes a civilization
Somali
to
pirates.
Support. Well, even if you steal one, you can't, like, field it, refuel it, reload it, you cannot keep it going unless you have a civilization, and I really felt like that was cheating. Like, it takes a huge portion of my GDP just to keep my army rolling, and these guys can somehow keep these massive nuclear powered vehicles going without having an entire tax base and, you know, everything supporting their tech. What do you mean?
It runs on the power of piracy.
Yes. Well, no, like, literally, where do you go to fuel your battleship that you are not a member of a state of? Like, where...
Exactly. You siphon on uranium one. The tanks, Chris.
Yeah, exactly.
Haven't you ever watched Alpha Centauri Park
they
Boys?
They mined Tiberium, and they put the Tiberium in the battleship.
Anyway, that's sort of my thing on Civ. My favorite Civ, I guess...
But
okay, if you want me to answer my favorite Civ, combat-wise, overall, I think Civ 5 is this really beautiful combat simulator. If you're talking about running a civilization and building it from the ground up, I think Civ 4 can't be beat in terms of, you know, culture, religion, all of that stuff. And if you're looking for just an experience of feeling like you're actually ruling a civilization, I really like Civ 2. So I guess, because you get all that role-playing
yeah,
elements,
that's right.
I guess
Civ 3 sucks.
Civ 3 is the loser in that, I guess. And
that's the Alpha only Civ game I've ever played.
I don't like
poor
Civ
baby.
3 all that much.
Civ 3 is so terrible. Civ 3 did that thing where it introduced a lot of important concepts. Consumable resources were pretty much, not introduced, they were introduced in Civ 2, but they were sort of made important in Civ 3. Culture was introduced in Civ 3. Civ 3 is a lot like Civ 5 in that sense. It was a big sort of sea change, but it didn't balance.
That Civ 4 felt like an improvement, like an iteration on Civ 2, and Civ 5 felt like an iteration on Civ 3, was basically my impression of the series.
Above all, if you want good menu music, you got to go with Civ 4.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of sad
especially
about that.
Especially the Space Jam remix. Yeah, the
I'll
soundtrack
put it in, the show notes.
In Civ 5 is way worse than... Even the ambient sounds are far worse than they were in Civ 4. Like, Civ
they're
4
not,
was cool.
They're not bad, but they're just not as good as Civ 5 or Civ 4.
You were near jungle, you would have, like, jungle sounds everywhere, and, you know, you were in a forest, you'd have forest sounds, you were over water, you'd have water sounds, and I thought that was really cool. Civ 5, it's all sort of just muted and
Civ 5
bland.
It, yeah. You know, it Go ahead, Retz.
Can I actually just share something? Because you guys are talking about a lot of high concept stuff. You know, you're talking about like, oh, you know, the ambient sounds are better in this game. You know, this game, you really feel like you're in control of the civilization. In this game, you know, you're the military has a lot of granularity and a lot of fine-tuned control, and it really offers an appealing simulation. So I want to tell you about the only thing I remember about any of my Civilization 3 gaming, which is... I played a bunch of different games of it, because, I mean, any Civ is addictive, even if it's the worst Civ, apparently. Any game is better than no game, right, guys? But the only thing I remember is this one time. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to play a long-form game, and I started out, and I started exploring, and I realized, hey, there was a lot of jungle to the north of me. And there was a lot of jungle to the east of me, too. Huh, there's a lot of jungle to the south of me. Huh. The
best place to start out.
And effectively, after a while, I discovered that basically any civilization is on the other side of the jungle, and you can't build roads on jungle. And it's really dragging down all of the effectiveness of production. So I was like, well, I guess I'll get some workers and I'll have them start clearing out this jungle. I'll just start having them deforesting. You know how long it took to deforest a road to the nearest civilization? And like
2,000 years.
In terms of turns? About 2,000 years is about right. It was a lot of turns, let me put it that way. It took like days of playing to blaze this road through. To get to the point where I had a dirt fucking road leading to the nearest dude so that I could trade my honey for his horses, and frankly, I wanted a goddamn achievement for it. I wanted that to be the victory condition.
You
built a shitty dirt road
initially, because it's been kind of a rule with Civ games where you can't clear jungle without ironworking, which is interesting considering that the great jungle civilizations that I can think of, basically Mesoamerica, didn't have iron.
Yeah, what
working.
The fuck,
what
actually?
About,
that's
what
really
about,
stupid.
Did the Zulus live in jungle? I'm honestly asking. I don't know. I don't mean like Civ. I mean real
okay,
Zulu.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Zulu are southern Africa, so yeah, they were a jungle civilization. I mean, lots of African civilizations are jungle.
Also, early Indian civilization. There's lots of rainforest civs, really, if you think about it.
Yeah, I
well,
actually don't believe I had
Indian
iron.
Early Indian was like Indus River Valley, which was not jungle.
Let me put it this way: there's something my civilization really needed, and there was none of it near me. And the only way I could get it was by trading via road with another civilization. That was my situation.
Again, Civ 3 kind of sucked for pretty much all that stuff. Like, they introduced resources, but they really didn't know how to use them. Or they introduced resource importance, but it didn't really... They had this thing where you had to, like, travel the road and have a direct connection. And much later, with Civ 2, or Civ 4 and Civ 5, it became... Civ 4 was probably the most lenient with that stuff, where you basically... You had the resource if you worked the tile, and then you could trade it freely at no cost and nothing to you. And then in Civ 5, they reintroduced sort of the finite resources, or they introduced finite resources, where every tile gave you one of that resource, and so you couldn't just act like it was infinite. And at right. the time, that was a big deal. Like, that doesn't sound like a weird thing, but in Civ, when it's like, you found oil, that means you have oil,
yeah.
almost infinite oil. And in Civ 5,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
you found an
like
oil
you
tile,
can...
you have one oil.
Yeah, to clarify, like, in trades, resources were not infinite, but, like, you would trade one copy of oil, and if you had two copies of oil, then you would be giving the other Civ you're trading with the unlimited ability to make oil-based units, and you, if you still had oil, would also have the unlimited ability to make oil-based units, whereas in, like, Civ 5, it's, if you have two oil, you can build and maintain two oil units, like two destroyers or whatever.
Or trade them.
Sell one of those oils, then you can, you know, then you can only have one destroyer or so on, and they can build one. Yeah.
Okay, so we're a little over an hour. Do we have time for a question you think, Seamus, or do you think
it's really only an hour?
We're way over an hour.
Yeah, I was actually...
We're an hour and a half.
Okay, well, I guess that's the diecast for the May 11th / May 15th or whenever this goes up. So enjoy it, people of the future who are now hearing this word for the first time.
Yes, anyone? Enjoy this podcast that we have done.
Smooth campster.
It's always a train wreck, damn it!
Okay, we need...
Okay,
we can't go out like that.
Good enough.
We can't go out like that. We need to play them.
Good enough, damn it!
Baba yetu yetu yule. Munde yetu yetu mina. Baba yetu yetu yule.